Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/NSS. And by IT Pro TV. A good IT pro is always learning, and IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/NSS and use the code NSS30.
Good? You feel good? Okay. Okay. You lose? Okay.
Leo sets things on fire. Virtual reality coming to a classroom near you and how to set up Raspberry Pi from scratch. Live from the Twit Brick House in downtown Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers.
Utah, brought his family out here, his daughter's out here. Shining a moment. Nice job. Thank you, Gary, for giving us the screensavers open. And look who's here.
Woo.
It's Roger Chang. Hey, Roger, how are you?
Good.
My old friend. When did you work on the screensavers? When did you work on Call for Help?
So, screensavers 98 to 2000, first half of 2001.
You were right out of college, San Francisco
yes.
State, right?
Yeah, I was 23.
Little kid.
Oh, I was thinner. Definitely thinner.
Now you got a baby.
I have a baby. I have a wife. I have a mortgage somewhere, I'm sure.
I love having you. Right now, Roger's working with Tom Merritt and
yes.
on the Daily Tech News Show, DTNS.
Yes.
That's awesome.
It's great. It allows me to be home and look after the kid.
So really, you're kind of almost a full-time parent.
I am a full-time. I'm
That's
kind
nice.
Of a stay-at-home. I worked it out with my wife where I would be kind of the stay-at-home parent because my job is a little more flexible, and she would have the kind of full-time with benefits from Stanford job.
That's nice.
Yeah.
You could do that. And how is it? What's your daughter's name?
Eloise.
How is it being home with Eloise every day?
It's good. It's definitely a new experience.
Yeah.
It's definitely a different experience. It's not the same one that you had when you were single.
Well, I'm so happy to see you again. Love having you. Thank you for
joining us. Thank you for having me.
The new screensavers, baby.
Very swank set.
Is your name on this here?
No,
I don't think so. We could get you to sign that before you leave.
Awesome.
Then it'll be complete. Because it has everybody else from the old screensavers. So we're coming up. We've got a great show for you. I'm going to set steel on fire. Didn't know you could do that, did you?
It's a fast form of oxidation. So if it rusts, it can burn.
This is why I love Roger. If it rusts, it can burn. You're right. That makes sense. That's incredible. You're going to see an incredible demonstration of 3D technology for the classroom. It's going to blow your mind. And you know, as Eloise gets older, you're going to probably want to turn her into a geek, right?
I've been kind of, I'm not sure if I should kind of force the issue.
No, you can't force it.
And so,
you don't want her to hate it.
No, I definitely don't want her to hate it, but it needs to be something she chooses.
Yeah, well, we're going to show you. You can kind of start, if you have, like, leave some Raspberry Pis lying around, like just lying on the table, let her discover this. I think she's going to be excited. We're going to show you, we have a Raspberry Pi educator. Going to show you how to get started with Raspberry Pi.
Awesome.
I think that's a lot of fun. Before we get going, though, let's talk about some of the big stories this week. I picked a couple for you.
Okay.
I always try to keep my co-host in mind. So story number one, this weird story about this text string you could send to Skype, 8 characters, and not only crash Skype, but once they're in your chat history, you can't open it again.
Nope.
So this is interesting because it's very similar to a bug that happened to Apple's Messages program.
Mm-hmm.
Same idea, a Unicode string sent to Messages would crash Messages and keep crashing it every time you tried to open it. If you have messages on your lock screen, it crashed your phone. Yep. Now, it's an interesting thing because Apple has not yet fixed the messages flaw.
And Skype did it within like a day and a half.
Not even, yeah.
So, yeah.
One day.
Yeah, one day. And either someone lit a fire under Skype or Microsoft is like, whoa, we need to get this done, fixed. It does kind of raise the question of where, I mean, there is a workaround for the iPhone.
Yeah, not really. You can, you want to know what the workaround is? You take messages off your lock screen, okay? Don't display messages. And then if you get the message, you can't stop getting the message. People are finally tired of it. If you're, by the way, I feel sorry for you if you're in seventh or eighth grade because your friends continue to send you this, right? But you, what you have to do is use Siri. You go, hey, Siri.
Yeah.
Open messages. Read me that message. Delete the message. You can only do it with Siri. If you see the minute you see the text, it crashes again. And they haven't fixed that.
It's definitely a very, it's a workaround. It's not a good or a clean workaround.
Do you use an iPhone?
No. I use an Android phone.
I like how you say that.
I use an Android phone.
Well, what's funny is that the Skype flaw didn't affect Macintosh users, but Windows users. Microsoft makes Skype. They fixed it right away. I have to say, I'm sure it's a different fix. It's something else they have to fix. It's not the same. You got to test fixes, et cetera, et cetera. But it does raise the question, how come Microsoft could fix this text? It's clearly a text rendering flaw in one day, and Apple, here we are, it's almost 10 days later, nothing.
I think one is because it's essentially a desktop client, and for Apple, it might be something with iOS where they actually have to...
Yeah, it's in Cortex, they're rendering.
And that they'll
text
have
running,
to
so they
roll up their sleeves and actually wrench.
What a mess. Another story that I thought you might be kind of interested in, and kind of a shocker, when we were doing the shows on Tech TV, we liked SourceForge a lot.
Yes, I used to use it all the time, especially for setting up for the shows.
It was the repository of open source software. They own Slashdot.
Yeah, I remember we had Commander Taco.
Yeah, Commander Taco. So it was like this bastion of free and open and you know, the geek world. Not anymore.
The whole thing is that now they're basically wrapping adware into the downloads that you get off it.
Horrible!
And these are for abandoned or projects that have kind of plateaued out.
Well, the two that come to mind are the GIMP, which is like everybody's favorite Photoshop replacement, free open source Photoshop replacement, and Nmap, which is like the tool for pen testing. It maps your network, tells you what processes are running and something. Both developers have moved off SourceForge, say, yeah, we don't have anything to do with that. I just feel like this is reprehensible. CNET does the same thing.
CNET I used to use download.com.
Don't use that anymore.
Don't use it anymore. And I think, you know, I liken this to kind of, I don't want to say gentrification, but you know
it is.
You know how you know how like a neighborhood gets gentrified and all the really cool places that you used to enjoy going to are now covered with hipsters.
Right.
And you just can't find a parking spot because a bunch of people in skinny jeans won't let you through.
What's wrong.
And everything's overpriced for what it is. And that's, I mean, you know, on one hand, it's the inevitable, you know, march of progress and making money. But, you know, hopefully, I mean, I think GitHub was offering a repository for a project that we're moving off of Chrome.
Right.
Or not Chrome, Google's code.
Code base. Oh, yeah, they killed code engine. Yeah.
And so I'm hoping something like that will happen.
GitHub is still a good guy, thank goodness. And I use them. I love them like crazy. I used to love and use SourceForge like crazy, not anymore. I feel like not anymore. They got sold, right? That's what happened. Somebody else bought them. They got gentrified.
Money.
Yeah.
Money.
Now they got like potted plants in the lobby. You know, they have a latte machine.
Hot,
somebody's got to pay for that.
Water.
Somebody's got to pay for that.
Apparently it's us.
Hey, let's get to our first call. Time for a little help. Help me. We got Scott on the line from Gainesville, Florida. Do you remember the old Netcam network?
Yes.
This is a little bit better. We're using Skype. I hope we're using Skype. Hey, Scott.
Hi, how's it going?
It's great to see you. Remember the Netcam network? They'd have
one
frame every second, and they'd have to use a phone for the
Kwanzaa
audio. And you were living the Quonset hut. Good things come to those who create. I like that. Are you a creator, Scott?
Yes.
What do you do?
I think mostly my kids are the creators.
Well, that's
I'll
good.
I'll be up there with you soon enough, I'm sure.
I feel like kids are creative, and then we kind of get it beaten out of us, right?
Yeah, you know, at some point, I think the rigors of paying rent and it's
I blame bills. Gentrification, Roger. That's what the problem is everywhere. Gentrification.
Could be.
Scott, what's your question for us?
Well, my question is about HD-DVD. Now, you know, back in the day, there was a lot of players that you could, you know, real physical plays you could get. And I bought Total Media Theater 5 because of Robert Herron told
Well, know, I do everything Robert says. Yep.
Well, they updated to 6, and when they updated to 6, they might be higher now, but they took out HD-DVD support. Now, you could still go to an Xbox USB and go that way, or...
Yeah, because you need... So, first of all, I hope you got a great deal on those HD-DVD discs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. I got them on eBay.
In fact, I have...
All at once.
I didn't know there was a market. I have a whole collection. Universal sent me like 20 HD-DVD discs. You do too?
Yeah, I have like 30.
So, Roger, we should get an eBay going here.
They're really cheap now. You can get them on...
You know why? You can't play them!
Right, exactly.
So I was a believer in HD-DVD. This was back in the day when it was Blu-ray from Sony. Toshiba had HD-DVD, and they were fighting it out in the marketplace.
It was definitely neck and neck, and, you know, when they
Microsoft Xbox came with an HD-DVD player. That, to me...
As an optional accessory.
It indicated maybe that HD-DVD was going to win out. There weren't any technical... I mean, they were similar, right?
They're very similar in bandwidth. I think one of the things with HD-DVD to its advantage was that the spec was sorted out, where Blu-ray at the time was still rolling out.
Right.
Okay, you have Tier 1, Tier 2.
And it's funny, because Sony had lost the Betacam versus VHS fight.
But they brought, like, the big studio. Disney.
That was the key.
I think when Disney came on board with Blu-ray, it was pretty much,
that was the key.
Because you're not... people are going to want Disney.
Some studios did both. But most studios chose one or the other. When Disney said, we're not going to do HD-DVD, we are going to do Blu-ray. But that's it. It's over. Right?
Yeah, pretty much. And the prices have come down, so the whole price differential...
No new movie has come out in years on HD-DVD, though,
no.
Right?
No. But for the longest time, it was the only way to get The Big Lebowski in HD format.
Now it's on Netflix. It's on Netflix. So you have... How many HD-DVDs do you have?
77.
Wait. So do you have a player? Do you have an HD-DVD player in your PC?
I have the player that I think it's HCG20L or something like that.
So you have a physical, because that's the first thing is you need a physical player that understands the HD-DVD format.
Well, I have the one that you know it's a
dual format drive.
Blu-ray. Yeah, dual format.
You were smart. You bought them before they all went out of existence.
Yeah,
I bought it at the same time that I bought the HD-DVDs, because that was a great way to add to my collection all at once. But I got to the problem where I can't play them on the computer.
And so you can physically play it back, but you need software that understands HD-DVD. That's what you're using the Total Media Theater for?
Yeah, it played... HD-DVDs through Total Media Theater 5.
Right.
But for some reason, I migrated to a new computer, and I don't know what I did wrong, but it just doesn't work anymore. It crashes every time I bring it up. So that's a separate problem. I'm not really, you know, interested in trying to solve that problem. I think that my real question is, like, all right, remember a few years ago there was games that you couldn't play anymore because... they were locked, and the Library of Congress said that you could break the copyright protection on the game and just to get to your content. Are we in that sort of situation now with HD-DVD because it's fast falling out of support from everybody?
So you want to find a way to crack the encryption so you can rip the disc and watch it on your hard drive?
Well, right. Actually, I know how to do that. I just didn't know...
Oh, is it legal? That's an interesting question, because somebody called the show today, the radio show today, and said, I know the Supreme Court said it's okay to do this. And I said, no, actually. The Home Audio Recording Act allows analog copies for backup purposes, but the DMCA explicitly forbids getting around DRM
for any purpose, even archival backups. So technically, it's illegal. But you know what, Scott? I don't think anybody's going to come to your door and say, Scott, we heard you have 77 HD DVDs you've copied. In fact, to your credit, you bought the media. You own the movies.
Exactly.
Are you going to torrent them? Are you going to share them, like, once you rent them?
No. That's not what I'm interested in. I just want to be able to
So why are you letting people know?
On a hard drive and stream them to my brand new 4K TV that Robert Herron told me to buy.
Let me put it this way. We won't say anything if you don't say anything.
Scott who? I don't know any Scots. I think, my friend, you are about to take the left-hand path, as they say in Silicon Valley. More power to you. I think where's Father Robert? We need to bless him. We bless you, and we say, go forth and duplicate. You have our permission. It is technically illegal. I have never heard of anybody getting in trouble, especially since you own the originals. You don't plan to sell them. You're not going to put a blanket on your lawn, are you?
I think the big deal is if you were trying to distribute after you ripped it.
Like, that would be the then you'd get in trouble.
If you were having like a garage sale, like, these hard drives have 77 movies on them.
Right.
And I'll give it to you for $20.
Yeah.
Probably not a good way to go, but
I admire your honesty though, Scott. I think
it is.
Most people would just say, "Oh, the hell with it."
Are you asking us because someone bugged you about it, or is this like it's weighing on my conscience and I need to get the truth?
Well, no, I was more curious if it would fall under that, like the game situation.
Where, it does not. As far as I know, and I'm not a lawyer, but as far as I know, there is no exception or exemption that allows you to do that with digital media, and there's never been a court case about it.
Especially since pretty much most of those movies are already out on Blu-ray, and the argument could be,
oh, yeah
you just buy them again.
There's an economic hazard.
I mean, go to Amazon, you get like five for $13.
No one is ever going to fault you if you have the original, even on HD DVD, for making an archival copy, especially because you can't play back that format. All you do is you say, Your Honor, I can't play this. I can play this. It's just one. I've replaced one with the other. This is the funny thing. The music industry realized the copy protection didn't work. They've dropped it, right? No record is copy protected anymore. The game industry realized copy protection doesn't work. They don't use it anymore.
They moved on to a different system for that.
Well, digital saved them, right? Yeah. Digital downloads and so forth. The only industry that still thinks copy protection makes any sense at all is the television and motion picture industry. As everyone knows, it doesn't stop a pirate. Pirates don't have your scruples, Scott. They just go, yeah, I'll just take that off. And then they sell it. The only people it stops is honest, poor honest people like Scott, who says, well, I have the disc, but can I rip it? Well, yes, rip it, for crying out loud. And I don't care who hears me.
But I will say, don't use our testimonies as any kind of...
I'll go to court. No, I take it back. I'll go to court. I will testify expert witness. Your Honor.
I have a kid to feed.
My kids are fed. Hey, thank you, Scott. Hey,
you can tell Martin that I'm the original Gator from Gainesville.
Remember He'll know that.
Show?
He'll know that.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, that's awesome. Gator from Gainesville. You know what? The chat room recognized you before I did. That's awesome. That's right. Thank you, Gator.
All right,
thanks. Take care. Wow, it's Gator from Gainesville.
Yes.
If you'd like to be on the show, here's how, Jim.
Need tech help? The new Screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
Coming up in just a little bit, if you've got kids, you know, and you have kids, that sooner or later they're going to want to get on Instagram. Megan Maroney, she's our resident mother. She's going to tell you what to do if your kids want to get on Instagram, a way to make it possible. But first, let's talk about our sponsor for this half of the show, the fun and fabulous folks at Braintree Payments. Braintree Payments, amazing. Their V.0 SDK, which adds all kinds of payments, Apple Pay to your mobile app, Bitcoin, Venmo, PayPal, of course, every credit card. And this is so cool. If you have a mobile app and you want to add a payments API, 10 lines of code, almost any language. It is very simple. In fact, you can go right now to braintreepayments.com/NSS. Try the sandbox. And just as a little bit of a sweetener, your first $50,000 in transactions are fee-free. If you're a mobile developer, you want to accept purchases. You know you do. This is a great solution for you. braintreepayments.com/NSS.
as Uber uses it, Lyft uses it, Airbnb uses it, Hotel Tonight uses it, GitHub, we're talking about GitHub, they use it. They use it from day one. This is the way to go. Braintreepayments.com/NSS. And we thank them so much for their support of the new Screensavers. Megan?
Hi, I am Megan Maroney. Here is a quick parent hack. You just gave in to the begging and the pleading and allowed your child to get an Instagram account. Legally, they have to be 13, but nobody's going to check if they have an email address. First, go into settings and make sure their account is private. That means they have to approve followers. So it's a good idea to talk to them about who it's okay to approve and who it's not okay to approve. A private account isn't going to keep them from posting photos that might be inappropriate or embarrassing or simply against your parenting values. You might want to have a conversation about that too. Now, log into your Instagram account and follow them. If you're not a regular Instagram user, you can get notifications whenever your child posts. Just go to their profile, click the three dots on the top right, then choose Turn on Post Notifications. That's it. You'll get alerts on your phone as soon as they start posting those selfies. If you have an Apple Watch, you can get alerts there too. It's not stalking, it's parenting.
Thank you, Megan Maroney. I'm back here with Dave Chavez. He is with Z Space VR, and I saw the video, and I was blown away, but I thought, you can't possibly do this. Welcome, Dave.
That's right. Thanks.
Let me show. This is the video you guys shot, right?
ZSpace is a sort of a three-dimensional computer.
I was carrying a jet engine when I was using ZSpace.
You can see inside of it.
And also you can, like, manipulate it in different ways.
You can't see inside of them when you see them in real life.
So a little bit about what we're doing with the ZSpace pilot. We started piloting initially with fifth graders for heart dissection and to help extend their learning about anatomy.
The first time that they sat down and started actually interacting on the systems, there was a constant conversation happening between them. They were excited, they were sharing, they were looking on each other's systems, and by the time they left, they were talking about how excited they were to learn about the heart, which was going to be the concept that they were going to be learning on it.
So we have some teachers that are now exploring using ZSpace with national monuments in social science. We have teachers using it as a design tool.
Together with the LASD team, we're helping to realize the potential of ZSpace in the classroom and craft the experience in a way that benefits their learning. It's really exciting to see where it's going.
No way. These kids are wearing inexpensive polarized glasses, right? These are like the real D glasses you get at the movie theater.
They're very close. Super light, super comfortable.
Yeah, and cheap. All right, so they're passive.
Passive.
Which is nice. You don't have to charge them. You don't have to connect them to anything.
That's right.
Now, I'm looking at a screen. Now, first of all, the weird thing happens, because this is a 2D screen I'm looking at. This is your ZSpace screen. I see their cameras. Is that what these are?
That's right.
There's a bunch of cameras on the top of the screen. And this looks like a 2D screen, just a regular 2D screen. Then I put on the glasses, and something weird happens. It starts to come up out of the screen. And I'm, by the way, 3D is not my favorite thing, but look at this. Now you figured out a way to show this, which is pretty awesome. So should I pick up, what should I do? Should I?
Yeah, try the ruler or that.
Pick up the ruler.
Yep.
So I move this light pen, and look at this. What the heck? I can even turn it around and read what's on the back of it. And I got to tell you, as the user experiencing this, it's like it's coming out of the screen. Not quite like you're seeing at home, but very close to it. Let me get that butterfly. Can I get him?
That's right. Put the plant in that circle over there.
Put the plant in the circle.
And let go.
And what would this be used for? Oh, now I'm in the plant. Now I can get the butterfly? Hello.
And you were teaching kids science, technology, right? Newtonian mechanics, biology.
I even see I could pick up this camera. If I touch it, I can move the camera, which is the point of view, right? I can move that around. And I could see in the screen behind me, you can't really see that, but I could see the point of view moving. So, I was talking with a friend of mine who's a nurse yesterday. She said, I hated dissection in school, like dissecting a frog. If you could do this with a virtual frog.
Absolutely.
And have the experience. Absolutely. So as you look at what the room is seeing, it's very different from what I'm seeing. Now, if there were two kids with the glasses on, would they both see a 3D?
They both would. They both could. The perspective is only correct for one student.
It's not lenticular, right? Though, or is
it's
it?
It's not.
Okay.
It's not. It's a different technology.
So it's not one of those 3D technologies where I have to be standing in a very specific
That's
spot.
That's right. In fact, as you pick the butterfly up and move your head around, you can look.
I can look underneath. It's so
And that's a big part
weird.
Of the experience. Try this. Click this here. Let me show you how it might.
So click this circle?
Click that circle. That's right.
The edge of it?
Yep, okay. Now pick up the doctor.
Pick up the doctor.
Put her in that same circle.
And put the doctor in the circle?
It's safe.
Put the lime in the coconut. Yep. Okay, now,
slide the lungs off to the left.
Slide the lungs up. Wait a minute. Pick up the lungs.
Go off the mat to the
left.
Oh,
my golly.
And now just
I am dissecting.
Enjoy that for a minute. Pick it up and...
That's a heart. Anybody want to... yeah, Roger, I hear you're pretty heartless. Would you like... No, I'm just... Wow.
And
I can rotate this and look at different parts of it.
Try the camera.
Just by grabbing the heart, all right? And so can you see this little window right here? I put my hand in the window. That's the camera view, so I can look underneath it.
And go right in the main chamber.
What? I can go inside? Holy moly. Look at that. I could see the ventricles, the aortas, the aisles of Langerhans, everything.
There's a button there that'll make those services transparent.
And then you How do I do that?
It's that
The funny button?
That's right.
Oh,
and now pick it up and look inside. And imagine how kids are getting immersed in exploring and...
This makes it, I mean, you know, is this better than holding a plastic model? I don't know. But boy, it sure is more engaging. Sure is more fun. And it's moving. It's pumping.
When kids are recounting the concepts that they've learned here, we see them holding their hand up, imagining
it's 3D.
That they had it.
Yeah.
It's,
how hard is it to author the content for this?
That's a good question. It's getting easier and easier, right? The game development community has been pushing this for a long time.
So what tools are they using?
Unity 3D is a great one.
It's Unity.
This one's in Unity.
This is Unity. Mm-hmm. So that is a wonderful cross-platform game development tool
it's
a lot of developers use.
You drop in our tools of a stereo head track camera, and you get most of what you have here for free.
Wow. Oh, so you have a stereo head track camera, too. Or no?
We have a prototype for it that drops into your Unity application and gives you this experience.
Oh, I see.
That's right. And the same
thing simulated. For the
stylus. That's
right. Yeah. What else can I do here? This is cool. Can I put the heart in the hole? No. Let's put the lungs back. I want to put the lungs. Poor guy. How does
a whole set of applications where we're teaching kids electricity.
Let's put the heart. Can I put the heart in the lung or no? It's probably too late to take. I've taken it. Once I've broken it, I can't. I had this experience in school, too. You take the guy's heart out, you can't put it back. Very cool. Isn't that neat?
We have a whole set of applications. We hold all kinds of content. We're in almost 100 schools across the country. The kids and the parents and the administration just love it.
How expensive is this for a school? So you need this special display.
That's right. And a computer to run it.
Okay, but that's a standard Windows PC.
Yep, that's right. On top of Windows.
Okay.
And so we sell them in a groups of 10 or 12 in what we call a STEM lab.
Right.
And that's about $70,000, something like that.
But not a lot for a science lab. This is not an unusual experience.
Comes with professional development for
and
the
teachers. And how much software is there available for?
There's a handful of applications, and there's more and more coming from the outside.
Wow. Look at that. I just could just take that heart out. Can I walk away with it?
You almost can.
I feel like I can.
It's a pretty natural interface, right?
It is so natural. It's so amazing. I mean, it's just totally... And by the way, I'm not a fan of 3D movies. I don't really have very good 3D, my eyes, but I have no trouble seeing this. This works beautifully. I didn't have stereo vision, but apparently I do. That is really, really cool. All right, you said you had something that you were going to surprise me with. What is that it? Was that the heart? Okay. That is really neat. Dave Chavez, where can people find out more about ZSpace VR?
ZSpace.com or edu.zspace.com.
I feel like there's a lot more. Like, what if I click?
There's a lot more. Click here. Well, this is just one demonstration application to get you going.
Okay.
But we've got...
Can I go in the house?
Try it.
What's the house?
Pick it up and put it in the... why not?
So I get it. So I get the interface. Once you put it in that hole, you're looking at it.
So you can push that red tab down, for example, and you can...
So you get the... You have to get the pen button. Close enough.
Yeah, with the... And just kind of...
There we go. Oh, I see. Oh, I just didn't understand what I was doing. I can do the cross-section view.
Try this.
Look at that.
Click this. This will let you resize that watch.
Okay.
Click that once. Go to the face of the watch and pull it back. Get a little closer and then pull it back till it's maybe 10 inches.
Ooh. Whoa.
That's
Whoa.
Good. Right there. Now go here.
Whoa. Now I'm going to go back to the 3D
rotating. And now imagine it's rotating. eBay or Amazon or
wouldn't that be cool? Do you imagine that it'd be used in more than just schools? That
absolutely,
you could have this in a shop, and people could examine a product up close.
Wow, e-commerce and medicine and the patient side of medicine.
I could see a telesurgery. This would be kind of neat.
Telesurgery. I could show you DICOM data here, which I did earlier. It was just
so this is a kind of a standard 3D. I know you can't see my hand, but there's a 3D screen here. That's kind of standard, like a movie 3D screen, that this...
It's pretty special to allow you to get the full resolution and use the passive eyewear.
Okay.
So we have it...
What is the resolution? It looks very high resolution.
It's full HD. It's 1920 by 1080.
That's great.
It's 120 hertz.
And when I put the glasses down, and that's kind of interesting for a classroom, it goes back to 2D. So it knows if I'm using the glasses and manipulating these objects in 3D or if I'm just looking at it.
And then the classroom uses this technology to, so the teacher can give a presentation to the whole class or kids do
it. Neat. But, so you couldn't really have 30 kids all wearing these glasses.
No,
it can't. Really would be for one-on-one. No?
Well, because the second kid has a special pair of glasses that allows them to interact.
So one kid gets to do this,
right,
and the others are watching.
And a big difference between other kinds of VR is here it's the kids aren't isolated, right? So you and I can have this interaction. We can see each other. We can work together.
Looking for industrial design purposes, this would be kind of interesting. You could actually look at a 3D model before you printed it.
I'll show you that real quick. Click this and then pick up that cylinder. That's in there too. Pick up that cylinder, put it in that circle if you
all right, let's look
like
at this.
The metaphor.
I do.
Let go. Take the cover off that arm. Actually, you can see how sensitive it is.
Wow, it is. It's really amazing. Yeah. Look
and
at that.
And so now you could be collaborating across the world on doing design. Right?
I'm disassembling the Terminator.
Same thing happens with the camera. The camera's got a little light on it, which is kind of fun.
It's kind of out there. You've got to get the right. Yeah, see, maybe this is where my 3D. Oh, look at that. So you see what you're looking at there. Very cool. I want one of these in my house.
And when you add... Oh, did you...
How many schools? 100 schools, you said,
are
using this?
100 schools across the country, yeah, and it's growing quickly.
Is it considered... I mean, it's 70,000 is a lot for a school. Is it considered to be kind of a luxury for these schools, or...
Well, it's interesting about how it's rolling out. There's the schools are finding the money for it because the kids and the parents
kids
and the
love
administration,
it.
They just...
It's got a lot
I
of...
go to science nights, and the parents come and say... You're not going to believe what my
kid
is.
Can we do gaming? Could I play?
Gaming is mind-boggling, but it's kind of the cart before the horse, I think.
I think you're right.
Right?
I just put a P in there. I don't know what's going on. I could play Scrabble with this, though. That's very good. Hey, Dave, thank you so much. ZSpace, using VR, virtual reality education. I was kind of skeptical about virtual reality. This is more like augmented reality in a way, right? Because you're not... You're still in the world, but you're just seeing an augmented version of the world, which is
I consider
cool.
it a kind of a reduced version of virtual reality.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
If I took your whole field of view, you'd call that VR, right?
Right.
So
that's
this
the
is
difference.
Just part of that here on the desk.
Yeah.
You still get all the comfort, stability of the room, but you have this VR world right in front of you.
I think much more comfortable than kind of sealing out the world.
We believe so, too.
Yeah, yeah. Dave, nice to meet you.
Thank you very
much. Thank you. That's really cool.
My pleasure.
Wow. I am excited. We're going to take a break when we come back. Let's see... a little more about Raspberry Pi. We've talked a lot about Raspberry Pi projects. We have a Raspberry Pi educator to help you get started. And a little later on, I'm going to set metal on fire with my laser vision or something. I don't know. But first, here's Kevin Rose.
Hey, everyone. Kevin Rose here with my app of the day. If you're like me, you've had a smartphone for many years now. You probably have a bloated address book. You don't have certain people's last names. You have the wrong phone number. You have the wrong title. No photos. There is a solution for this called Full Contact. With Full Contact, you launch the app, you auth in your various social networks, and it allows you to quickly update everyone's photo, everyone's current title, and merge contacts easily with just a couple taps. If you're looking to really improve your address book, this is the app for you.
Kevin Rose, nice to see you again. Kevin will be back hosting another episode of the new Screensaver soon. Don't worry. In fact, we're going to have Martin Sargent back. Sarah Lane is coming up. Patrick Norton will be coming back. Who else? Who am I leaving out? Father Robert will be back. It's really fun. We're having a great time. I hope you're enjoying the new Screensavers. We do the show Saturday afternoons right after the radio show. It depends on what I'm doing, but right between 3 and 4 p.m. Pacific, 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern time. And we would love to see you here. So tune in if you can. If you can't, on demand, always available of all of our shows. twit.tv/NSS. And you know, by the way, the new website should be up by Thursday. So if you go to the website and everything looks different, it's supposed to. That's what's supposed to happen. Matt Richardson is here. He is a maker, a Raspberry Pi expert. In fact, he's the first U.S. employee of Raspberry Pi. Congratulations,
Thank
Matt.
You
That's
very
great.
Much.
Your
you.
New book just came out, actually, version 2 of the book, Getting Started with Raspberry Pi.
That's right.
Make Magazine's publishing that.
Yep, they're great.
So, first of all, fill us in. What is the Raspberry Pi?
So, Raspberry Pi is a full-on computer, and I mean that earnestly. So, you can connect a keyboard and mouse to it. You can connect a monitor as well, and I'll do that live.
You're
right
setting
there.
Up the USB, the HDMI.
Yep.
It's got memory. It's got a processor. It's got storage.
That's right. And I'm using just a regular cell phone charger here to plug in.
That's great. So that's micro USB.
Yes. Instead of a hard drive, we have a micro USB cable.
It's booting up.
Booting up here.
I love that. So this is booting up. It looks like Linux.
Yes, this is Linux. Our engineers work on a version of Debian called Raspbian, which is really suited to our mission and our hardware.
It also has to fit the processor. It's an ARM processor using in there?
Yes, ARM V7. Okay. The brand new one, Raspberry Pi 2, has got a quad-core 900 megahertz processor, 1 gig of RAM, still just $35.
That's kind of mind-boggling that I can buy a quad-core computer for $35.
Yeah, and that's our whole mission, is if we can make computers affordable, it means that more kids can play with them, try them out, they can experiment with them. If they mess something up, not a big deal. Just get a new one, or in fact, you probably don't even need to. You just swap out the micro SD card, and you can get going again pretty easily.
Well, I know this was created for education, because we talked to the Raspberry Pi founder. He was inspired by the BBC Micro, which taught a lot of kids. It was their first introduction to microcomputing. How many units have they sold now, Raspberry Pi?
We're right about at 6 million now.
6 million?
Yeah.
Now, a lot of parents get it for their kids and projects. And soon, I think, because of the Internet of Things, people are going to be, I know people using this for home theater PC systems. There's a lot of usage. It isn't educational. It's just a very inexpensive, very powerful computer.
There's a wide breadth of uses. We see a lot of use in education, of course. We see the hobbyists using, doing all kinds of crazy projects. And then also just the basic home theater PC stuff, as you mentioned. There's also the industrial use as well. Companies are using Raspberry Pis in their labs to prototype things, also create sensor networks in their warehouses. Tons of use in industrial. We don't always hear about it, though.
Right.
It's usually when I'm visiting a company and they say, take a look at this. You can't show it to anybody, but here's a way we're using Raspberry
Pi. So there's no restriction in the license that prevents you from using this for commercial purposes?
You can use it for whatever you want.
Whatever you want. Yeah. You bought a computer.
Yeah.
Now, absolutely. The $35 doesn't come with storage, right? So
that's
right. Buy a memory card.
Regular micro SD card, so the same kind you put in a digital camera. You get them at a drugstore, pop it in. They're really cheap these days. Eight gig card will do just fine.
8 gigs enough?
Yeah.
4 gig for Linux, and then 4 gig for your project.
Yeah, a little extra. And then any additional is helpful if you want to do extra stuff. Just download the software onto the micro SD card, pop it in, and you're booted up a full computer.
That's really amazing. The software is available online. Doesn't come with it, so I have to download it. I could download another computer, put it on the SD card, and that's it.
That's right. And there are people out there who sell micro SD cards that are preloaded with the software. Okay. And then also there are tons of other operating systems made by our community.
Yeah, there's an XBMC for Raspberry Pi. There's a lot of stuff
We're seeing a lot of people using Ubuntu now with Raspberry Pi. It's fantastic. So I launched into our desktop environment here.
Oh, you even have a graphical user interface?
Yes, a full-on desktop environment. And to show you a little bit about our mission here, we have a whole section for programming. Python 2.
Mathematica, this comes with it?
Yeah.
This is free?
You can use it for free. Yep.
Isn't Mathematica like thousands of dollars?
It's pretty expensive. You get it for free on Raspberry Pi. It's our partnership with Wolfram.
Thank you, Stephen.
Yep.
You also get Wolfram itself, the Wolfram language, their new language.
Right. Yep.
You get Python 2 and 3. Scratch is a great teaching language for kids.
Absolutely. Our resources use Scratch for the younger kids and Python for the older
kids.
Makes
a lot of sense.
Yep, they're great programming languages.
And what is that Sonic Pi?
Sonic Pi is a programming language for making music. It's procedural code. It's a great way to learn loops. When I see kids using Sonic Pi, they really take off because you type in 2 lines of code, you got music playing. And then before you know it, they're iterating on that. It's a fantastic tool.
Wow. So if you've got a monitor lying around, an old keyboard, an old mouse, it's just kind of USB standard stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
HDMI supported monitor.
It's all a la carte. So usually you have stuff laying around so that with just $35 you can get going. All these components, you can get a keyboard, mouse, $10, maybe even they find them in a junk pile in a company or something.
Most people watching this show probably have a few mice in the closet. So in programming, when you first use a new programming language, you write something called Hello World, the simplest possible program. And it teaches you, how to create a program, how to compile it, how to run it, where the output goes. You've got a hardware Hello World for Raspberry Pi?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people use these pins on the Raspberry Pi. These are the GPIO pins.
This is so funny. This term has come up on every single screensaver show for the last 4 episodes. General purpose input output.
Right. So you can program, you can read and write these pins to do whatever you need them to do.
And there's a lot of them.
Yeah, we've got 40 of them on there. They have different functions. They can change function as well. So The very, very basic way that you can program these pins is just by turning an LED on and turning it off again.
And there's like a command that says turn pin 30 on.
That's right. I'll load up here our file manager. I wrote a little bit of code in Python to, a blink.py. It's just a regular Python script here, and I'm going to move the terminal.
So you import a few libraries so you can talk to the GPIO.
That's right.
And you need a couple of little routines from the time routine, mostly just the sleep. So you set the mode, you set warnings to false because we don't want to see any errors.
Right, right.
You set up the GPIO, and now we got a loop. While true means keep doing this.
Keep going on and on. Turn the LED on, turn it off. And so now we just have to wire up the LED
and
here.
And you did pin 21.
Yes.
So you know where to plug that
in. There's a guide for our pinouts there.
Okay.
You're putting the
two green lead on one.
Missed it. There we go.
Yeah.
So we got the LED connected.
So now if you run this program, if all goes well, the LED should go on and off.
And we have to do it as super user, so then Python.
And 21 is what, milliseconds, seconds?
21 is the pin number that we're using.
Oh, that's the pin number. Well, how do we know how long it's going to go?
1 second. The sleep command there shows 1 second. So
it'll
be 1 second on.
Sleep one, sleep one.
So then I'm going to execute this, blink.py. And we got a blinking LED. That's
now, here's
the
test. Is it? Yes, every second it goes on and then it goes off. But you know what? That is really gratifying to be able to write something on the screen.
Well, you've got to start somewhere. And this, if you can make an LED blink, you can make a motor run, you can turn lighting systems on and off. This is where you start.
Tell me about this breadboard you're using.
So this is a basic prototyping breadboard. When you're just experimenting with electronics and you need to move things around, you'll pluck your components in there, and then you've got some power rails if you need them.
And it's kind of a, it's a grid. It's an X, Y axis.
Right.
A through I or J there. And 1 through 30 there. And so you where every pin is by its designation.
It's just to help you make connections between components.
Right.
Later on down the line, when your project becomes a little bit more real and it becomes more of a product-looking thing, you'll probably solder something together. But this is where you're just going to try things out. So you don't have to solder something down and desolder it, which is a difficult thing
to do. You just plug it in.
Right.
And you've got a light-emitting diode. That's the thing going on and off.
Yep.
And that looks like a resistor in
Why is
there a resistor?
You have to limit the current to the LED. You'll blow it out if you let all that current
That's
through,
part of the fun, kids,
is
forgetting
absolutely.
The resistor.
Yep.
And then you go, I think I need a resistor next time.
Right.
That's great.
Right.
Where do you get all these parts, though? I mean, we used to be able to go to Radio Shack and get resistors.
Yeah,
I haven't been able to do that in a while.
You can get them all over. Any place you get a Raspberry Pi, like MCM Electronics, you can get these accessories as well. Adafruit, they've got a ton of great stuff that include the breadboard, components. They've got kits.
I would love to just, 100 resistors of different of ohms, just a variety of things.
You can buy, a shelving
bin.
Unit that has bins in it.
Yeah,
the resistors are preloaded. It makes your workshop look really, hardcore.
What should we build today, kids? How neat is that? So that's Hello World for hardware.
Right, that's right.
We got it blinking.
Yep.
Very simple, and you're running software to do that. And you can do it in Scratch, too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a library that you can add on to Scratch to do GPIO stuff, and you can build robots with Scratch if you wanted.
What fun.
Yep.
What else should we know as we get started? You've got other stuff.
Yeah, I got something else I wanted to show. So in November, astronaut Tim Peake, he's a UK astronaut. He's going up to the International Space Station for a 6-month mission. He's taking 2 Raspberry Pis with him.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it's great. And the kid, there is a competition going on in the UK right now where kids are writing the code that will run on the Raspberry Pi. So you've got
AstroPi.
It's
your
AstroPi.
Code in space.
Yep, so kids can write the code that'll run in this sandbox in space because you've got all these critical life-supporting systems on the International Space Station. You just can't run any code you want.
No, of course not.
So you can run it on the Raspberry Pi. This Raspberry Pi will be sandboxed. The students are writing experiments. And
how do they communicate with it?
So what they'll do is they'll have the data right off to the card, and then when Tim Peake comes back to Earth after his mission, he'll bring the data back down.
And there's an actual experiment, or is it just lighting something up for fun?
Well, there's a bunch of different sensors on this AstroPi hat. And a hat, by the way, is a hardware attached on top. It's an extra module that you can add onto the Raspberry Pi.
Oddly enough, it's just like a hat.
Right, exactly. It sits right on top. And there's a bunch of sensors on there, humidity, temperature.
Cool. That's what these are?
Yep, well, these are a bunch of LEDs. Now, I can light up those LEDs. I wrote a little bit of code, and hopefully...
Oh, look, it's saying something. New screensavers in space!
Yep.
Anyways, that's awesome.
So yeah, that's how the thank you. So that's how the astronauts will be able to interact with Raspberry Pi, because they're not going to be able to get it onto the network, because there's a lot of certifications you have to do in order to do that. So
put
a little mini screen on there and a bunch of components.
But this hat has sensors built in for a variety.
Absolutely.
Of
and right now it's going through flight certification. You just can't send something to the International Space Station.
You should be able to send anything. They send hamsters. You should be able to send a Raspberry Pi. Come on.
So we've partnered with
UK. What could possibly go wrong?
Right. So UK Space Agency and the European Space Agency, they're helping us to certify this hardware to go up onto the International Space Station.
Kids are lucky today.
Absolutely.
They got 3D stuff. They can send a computer into space. I bet you that Raspberry Pi has far more computing power than the Apollo 11 landing module.
I mean, sure.
Easily. That is so amazing. And it all starts with a $35 Raspberry Pi. You can even get the older Pi, right?
Yeah, the older Pi is available now for $25. Wow. We even have a version now for $20 as well. It uses less power, has fewer USB ports. So there's really no excuse now.
It's a good idea, though, to go to a site like Lady Ada's Adafruit.com or MCM.com.
Yeah.
Because, is it MCM.com?
MCM Electronics.com.
Electronics.com. Because those people, you know, they're official. And they have all the pieces you need, and they have a lot of explanatory stuff.
Yeah, they do a really great job with their kits and their tutorials. And there's also kits. There's so many different places to get kits. If you don't have anything, you can always buy a kit that's got a bunch of these electronic components built in already. Or, Adafruit, I love them. I love MCM Electronics as well.
And you probably want to get the book from Make Magazine. It's Matt Richardson's Getting Started with Raspberry Pi. The second edition just came out. You could get an ebook or you can get a physical. I like having a physical book when I'm working with hardware. I can crack the spine, lay it out flat. I can look back and forth. So get a copy. Matt Richardson, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you for doing this. Congratulations on being the first U.S. employee for Raspberry Pi.
Thank you.
We kind of have a soft spot for Raspberry Pi, so I'm really glad to hear that you're here and doing this. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it. All right. I have a little bit of a commercial to do, and then we're going to answer another question. Roger Chang is waiting. You ready? You doing? You got your thinking cap on?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Before we do that, though, poor guy looks so lonely over there. He's just sitting there reading the paper. Nothing much to do. I gave up my daughter. Afternoon with my daughter. You're probably happy to talk to adults, actually, after you spend a lot of time at home.
Wife's an adult.
Oh, your wife's an adult. You're moving up. That's great. Thank you. Oh, that's terrible. Our show today brought to you by those good folks at IT Pro TV. Tim and Don saw what we were doing. They loved the Tech TV days, and they saw what we were doing at Twit. In fact, they saw a talk I gave at NAB a couple of years ago. They were teaching people how to take the test for a variety of certs, you know, A+ and MCSA, MCSE, all the certs that you would get if you wanted to get a better job in IT or maybe wanted to just improve your skills in IT. And they looked at this and they said, you know, we could do what they do at Twit right now. We could do maybe some sort of a live production and have the training. My God, they've got two studios. They do 50 hours a week. They've completely eclipsed everything we do. And you know why? Because what they're doing is great. If you want to get your Security Plus, your A+, your CISSP, your Network Security Cert, Linux, Windows, OS 10 desktop support, just go there and browse through. You'll see all the incredible courses they've done. They've just put up the new Ethical Hacker, Hacking Forensics Investigator, and Crypto courses. We were talking about those. Sean Philip Oriano, who wrote the book on this stuff, he actually consults with enterprise and military on security. He gave those courses, and they were stellar. They now have a search function on the site, so you can find any specific topic and a quick answer. Of course, they break the courses down by the actual test questions. It makes it very easy to test for an area you're having trouble with. And the members area now highlights recent course additions and allows you to resume right where you left off. If you buy a year, you can buy month to month, but if you buy a year, you buy the privilege of downloading these and putting them on your tablet or your PC so you can watch them anywhere, even in the air. I can go on and on. They got a virtual machine sandbox lab, so even if you don't have a Windows machine, you could do this with a Chromebook, any HTML5 browser. You can create a Windows server, configure the clients, break it like crazy. No harm, no foul. You even get the tests, the measure up practice exams, so you can see if you're ready to take the real test. Those are worth $79 by themselves. So here's the deal. If you go to itpro.tv/NSS and use the offer code NSS30, we're gonna give you a 7-day free trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account. Not the first month, Not the first day, not the first year, the forever. Again, that's itpro.tv/NSS and use the offer code NSS30 to save. They're going to be doing their PF Sense firewall course and their updated Network Plus course. Don Pezette does that. Their live stream is available for free. And that's from, and you can watch them live 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern every weekday. You know, if you're sitting here watching Twit, forget it. Watch something good. It's going to help you get a better job. IT Pro TV. Okay, we're okay, but they're great. itpro.tv/NSS and use the code NSS30. Try it free for 7 days. You'll save 30%. See, that's what you never did on Revision 3 is actually tell people stop watching and go watch more Netflix. If you had done that.
No, we did.
You did?
We definitely did.
Yeah. Didn't help. What was it? You worked on Techzilla, right?
Yeah. Yes.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Yes,
Poor Roger, it felt like I touched a nerve there.
No, it's like we did.
Yeah, you did. Didn't help. No. All right. Let's. I'm just trying to give you some advice here, okay? Let's say hi to Hosh. He's on the line from New Jersey. It's time to help me. Help me, Hosh. Hi, Hosh. Oh, look, I guess Hosh is. Is that a Rickenbacker behind you right there?
The one in the middle,
yeah,
is an original 1962 Hofner bass.
No, that's the Hofner violin. That's the Hofner violin bass that Paul McCartney used to play.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. Where'd you get that?
I've had it since I was a kid. And next to that, the white one, is an original 1968 Jazzmaster.
Wow.
Fender Jazzmaster.
Wow. Do you play the guitar?
No. Yes.
He collects them.
I haven't seen one of those Hofner violin basses since the early days of the Beatles. It's so cool to see that.
Isn't it something?
Yeah. It's unique. Is it too? Now, did you string it for a lefty?
No. No, I'm not a lefty, so it's strung for me.
That's how Paul played it.
I know.
Nice to meet you, Hosh. So are you professional?
Nice to meet you too.
Professional musician or what is or is this just your hobby?
No. Just a hobbyist, really. Just an amateur. Cool.
That's nice. I like your studio setup, though.
Oh, thank you.
Every studio should have knotty pine, don't you think?
Why not?
and mirrors on the ceiling.
Absolutely. You have a round bed that rotates? No, I don't want to know. So, Hosh, what's your question for us?
Well, I'm pretty excited about Windows 10 coming, and now we know when it's coming, which is pretty good. The only thing is I'm running an older Windows 7. And you know what happens? After a while, it gets a little wonky. You're not really into upgrading right on top of it.
Yes.
You know, you would normally right by now, I'd be thinking about flatlining anyway to start cleaning up.
Yes.
But this is coming pretty soon. And what I'd really like to do is get the outline of a procedure for downloading Windows, on making a separate partition on my active Windows 7 and run the Windows, load the Windows 10, run the Windows 10 for a while, get used to it, get to like it, and then slowly get my data over from Windows 7 over to Windows 10, get everything the way I like it, and then blow away the Windows 7 partition.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if there's like a direct, first of all, I don't even know, with all the mystery surrounding, I don't even know if Microsoft is going to allow that. If they're going to make me do an upgrade in place, or if they're going to let me do install on another partition.
It's a great question.
It's a big question mark because they said that they would, but they actually haven't detailed.
They haven't said how.
Yeah. So,
Roger Chang, do you like Windows 10? Are you a Windows 10 fan? You got Windows here. I see it.
No, this is. Oh, I have it on the browser, but I'm running OS 10 on this.
Oh, you're a Mac guy, huh? Right.
No, I run Windows 8.1 at home, and I use Creative Cloud, so I tend to be very cautious.
Oh, yeah, because you were doing a lot of editing with Adobe Premiere.
I do After Effects. I do Premiere.
We have the same situation. We run Dell workstations with Windows 8.1 probably, right? And Premiere. But yeah, what are we going to do, Alex, when Windows 10? We're not going to rush to update.
We're not going to rush to update. hours, we're going to test it.
Test it and see.
And typically when I move OSs, and because I've done it so many times, this is basically what my system looks like. I have four drives in my computer. I have the boot OS,
yeah,
which is on an SSD. I have all my installed applications on another SSD.
Mm-hmm.
And then I keep one drive, and it's like a 2 terabyte drive. That's my documents folder.
Yeah.
I move everything from my documents over to that.
So you have a D drive, basically.
So I have a D drive. And so
it's like
what,
a data drive.
So yeah. Every time I upgrade or blow out Windows, for example, when I move to Windows 7 to Windows 8, everything was still there. In fact, at least half of my applications outside of Creative Cloud would actually still launch without having to be reinstalled in Windows. And I didn't have to worry about all my document folders, like
I love
pictures,
that.
Videos,
yeah.
Anything, because it's on its own separate drive. Yeah. And so what I've basically done over the years is just keep a really small drive, an SSD, 128 gigs, that I put the OS on, and then I put everything else, installed programs, everything else on separate drives.
How do you tell Windows that it's... See, this, I've always had trouble with Windows with the installed programs. They seem to really want to be on C in the same drive as Windows itself.
So...
You must do some weird...
Yeah, you just click Browse and you select a separate
folder. Yeah, but see, you can't... It's not like...
Don't
you
ever
can just
do
use them because there's still stuff on the C drive, like in the DLLs are there
well,
and
no, so this
the registry's there. And
half of the programs have that issue, the other half don't.
Some work, some don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I'm surprised, like Steam actually works.
Really?
It just
Firefox will work. Anything that you could put on a USB drive.
Which is why I use portable apps.
Portable apps could do it.
But some applications start up and actually have no issue. And it's weird.
You gotta make a list of what works because that's useful to know.
It's great. And the great thing about this is I don't have to worry about the data. If the OS goes wonky and syncs, whatever, I still have all my data. The only thing I have to worry about is reinstalling the OS, and then the applications actually do need to install.
So you mentioned that, this new Windows 10 thing is so unclear, and Microsoft has done a terrible job of communicating it. They have an FAQ. Hosh, did you get the little icon?
I did, but only on one of my... three systems. So
that's
I'm waiting for the
thing
other ones.
That Microsoft has been unclear is like who gets it, who doesn't. I've got it on most of my systems. So, but doesn't mean you won't get to upgrade if you don't get the little invitation. It's just an ad, really. I'm not sure how they're doing it. Some said, oh, if you were in the Windows Insider program, you would get it. Are you in the Windows Insider program?
I'm not, no.
So that's not it.
I was going to be, but I never did it.
That's
never
the one that lets you beta test it. I don't recommend it. You don't need it because in a month, July 29th, 1 month, you're going to get it, 1.5 months.
I would recommend you just start migrating your data over to another drive.
I think that's a very
just
smart
migrate.
Idea.
At least
back it up, right?
Yeah, at least back it up. Anything you really want to keep, anything that's important to you that if you lost, you would be incredibly upset over.
Right.
But I think that this,
and you and I have for years recommended clean install for a new operating system. The way the upgrade seems to be working is you would install on top of your existing Windows 7 or 8. That's not desirable. The only reason we know that there will be some way to do the clean install is Gabe All, who's great on the Windows team. He tweets. Somebody asked him, Gabe, can I do a clean install if I take the free upgrade? And he said, yes, there will be a way. And that's all he said.
Okay.
So there will be a clean install. Here's what I'm guessing, but we won't know, I think, until Microsoft actually ships this thing. I'm guessing that there'll be some way to make recovery media, right?
They'll probably give you a way to do it,
yeah.
But it won't be the traditional, here's your CD, you drop it in and you just install from that.
Right now, the way Windows 7 and 8 work, you've got a recovery, on most, if you buy a like this Dell laptop, it's got a recovery partition with Windows install files on there. Obviously, when you're going to 10, you won't have a partition like that. Or maybe it'll make one. I don't know. Maybe it'll make a recovery. I guess it will make a recovery partition.
You have to if they don't give
you. Right.
You have to, right?
And then I would guess, I could probably almost with certainty guess, that they will say, would you like to make recovery media? It will take that recovery partition and put it on a USB key or a CD, and now you could do a clean install from that. And I would I think I'm going to do that. I think I would recommend that for anybody. I mean, this. I accepted the invitation on this. With this is a Windows 8.1 Dell. So you're not going to rush.
I'm not going to rush. But I've also noticed that Windows is a lot better behaved about that. So, long story short, I upgraded the motherboard and processor, my PC. I didn't reinstall Windows 8.1. It actually
and
just
it didn't
went.
Complain?
It didn't complain. It just reinstalled a bunch of stuff, and I had to sit back and then I had to reauthorize it. A
lot of questions. I don't know, Hosh, if you watch Windows Weekly. We literally spent 90 minutes on Wednesday
trying to hash out from the FAQ, from leaks from Microsoft, from tweets from
Google. I saw that.
I was like, well, I said, Paul, will it do this? I don't know. Maybe it will. I don't know. It's not clear. So, but
that's why I said there's a lot of mystery. It's just not clear.
But that is good news. And Gabe Ball has been very, very reliable. He's on the Windows team. He's actually become their social media guy. We had him on Windows Weekly a few weeks ago, and if he says you can do a clean install, we know that's going to be possible. How? We just don't know.
That's the most important.
But definitely do prep for it by moving over data, because that's the last thing you want to go missing if you do an install and it's like...
Right. I always keep I call it my D drive, because usually C is Windows and applications. I haven't tried this portable thing. I try. And then I have a D drive, which is just my data, and I never touch that with any install. That way,
so my D drive is all the applications I install. And then I have a scratch drive for Premiere and After Effects.
You're old-fashioned. You're
old
school,
you definitely want a separate drive.
You don't want to put it on your main drive.
Oh, no.
No. Hosh, it's great to meet you and your Hoffner.
Thank you.
Wow. That is so awesome. I'm very jealous. Can you play something for us? Rock out?
I think it might be secured. Secured well onto the wall.
I hope it's glued.
It's hard to entertain yourself with a bass.
Yeah. I don't know. I would entertain myself with a bass. Hosh, it's great to meet you. Hosh in the Naughty Pines, ladies and gentlemen.
I'll be here all week.
Thanks, Hosh. Take care.
Thank
We love having your calls. Please, ladies and gentlemen, do give us a ring. Here's Jim Cutler to explain how.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
If you live on the west coast of the United States, chances are that you got caught up in Comcast's latest outage. Outages are nothing new, but what makes it unique is that it was a DNS outage, which means you didn't have to lose your connectivity when Comcast lost theirs if you had been using a third-party DNS. DNS stands for Domain Name System.
When you type in an address like google.com, DNS turns that name into a number or sequence that can be used to reach that remote server. Unfortunately, not all DNS servers are created equal. Some, like the ones run by Comcast, are oversubscribed and tend to fail under crushing load. Using a third-party DNS is a great way to insulate yourself from their blunders and give you a potentially significant performance boost for free. In Windows 7, go to Start, Control Panel, Network and Sharing Center, then click Local Area Connection. You'll get a pop-up window for Local Area Connection status. Click Properties, select Internet Protocol Version 4, and click Properties once again. Towards the bottom of the window, you'll see an option to use the following DNS server addresses. Enable that selection and type in your two favorite DNS servers. My personal choices are Google's DNS server at 8.8.4.4 or 8.8.8.8, and OpenDNS at 208.67.222.222 or 220.220. Select OK. Close, and you're done. Your computer will now use those third-party DNS servers instead of your ISPs. In Mac OS X, you need to go into the System Preferences and select Network. Select the connection that you want to configure, Ethernet or Wi-Fi, then select Advanced. Choose the DNS tab, and at the bottom of the DNS servers box, you'll find the plus sign, which will allow you to add your DNS server configuration. Add as many DNS servers as you would like. In my case, I'm adding Google and OpenDNS. Then click OK and apply. Now, if you want the performance of a third-party DNS server but don't want to have to input those settings into every device you have, you can set up third-party DNS within the router. Log into your router and find the section that controls the DHCP settings. You should see fields that define static DNS servers. If you add the third-party DNS servers here, devices that connect to your network will automatically be given those third-party DNS settings.
Follow these simple steps, and DNS will no longer be the Achilles heel of your internet experience.
I did that, actually, because we had that problem. And Lisa's sitting there going, the router's down again. Michael's screaming from the other room, the router's down again! I went and I unplugged the router and everything. It was Comcast. So, of course, I moved all of my DNS to... I should have done this anyway, OpenDNS. I've used them for years. I love them. They're really a great choice. OpenDNS.com. You can take a look. You know what this is? You've seen this. I've been talking about this for years. It's one of those, those face creatures. No, it's a Joby Gorilla Pod. These things are the greatest things in the world. And our next two guests, Zach and Amanda, do videos for Joby and others. In fact, I first met you when you were trying to roll your motorcycle into our studios a few years ago.
Yes.
You guys motorcycled across the country.
Yes.
We did.
It was 85 days, 12,000 miles.
Oh, man.
We did it. We were filming a documentary.
Yeah. Is that on? Can I see
it? Yes. You can rent it if you go to pursuithorizon.com.
Okay.
You can rent it right on there. Everything's good to go.
Oh, I have to watch that.
In fact, tell you what. If later on after the show I'll make an offer code for 25% off, just put in offer code TWIT.
Okay.
All lowercase. We'll
do all lowercase TWIT. Now, it's not active yet if you're watching live, but if you're seeing this after the fact. Yep. Say that website again, Pacific?
Pursuit Horizon.
PursuitHorizon.com. That's you guys.
Yes.
That's us.
Stop working, start living. So Amanda and Zach did that, by the way.
Yeah. And we stopped off here, and Joby was one of our sponsors at the time.
Because you had cameras all over the motorcycles.
Right. We ended up, that was so hard. The goal was to see, can we do an entire documentary and carry all the equipment ourselves without a support vehicle? We had three large film cameras, three helmet cameras, 7 1-terabyte hard drives, 2 laptops, audio recording. Then we had tent, sleeping bag, clothes, disclaimers, all trying to carry it on a motorcycle.
Crazy.
And film the whole thing.
I can't wait to see it.
It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
Too much
work. So Joby liked what you did, and they said, you guys should make more videos. It's always good if you're a YouTube creator to have a sponsor, right? So Joby and Low Pro are two of your sponsors that help you do these videos, right?
Yeah. So right now we both work for Damon, which Joby is the main one, and then there's a couple other companies involved in there, like Low Pro. And we basically create content all day with Amanda, and Amanda's our social media specialist, and she handles it.
I saw this video on YouTube of you guys playing with fire, and I said, I have to try that. But what was really interesting to me is it wasn't just any fire, it was steel wool. Do we have the YouTube videos of them messing around with steel wool, or am I just crazy? You got it? Here you go. Now, it's good because you had an actual fireman there. This is a giant ball of steel wool. And now what you're doing, though, is not just shooting the video. You're also doing a time exposure. You're opening the lens on the camera for about 10 seconds, something like that.
This one, I think, is almost 20. It'll say when the photo comes up because it's a large ball. This is a 12-inch ball of steel wool.
Amanda's smart. She got the heck out of there.
Which is about one full package.
Look at that. Oh, my goodness. That is fun. How'd you get the idea for this?
Actually, all of our advocates and our fans on our Instagram page were posting really, really cool images. And we started messaging them and asking them how to do it, and they gave us instructions. And this is the first time we ever went out to try it, is when we did the video.
It's really cool. It's actually great. Now, it's good because you not only have a fire extinguisher there and a large can of flammable materials sitting right there, but you have a trained professional. This actually is an actual fireman. Who does the pyrotechnics for Burning Man.
He's a pyrotechnics master, retired firefighter.
Wow.
Who does a whole lot of stuff for Burning Man.
All right. So I don't know who on my team thought this would be good if I did this, but the other day we went out to the parking lot. Rogers explained to me why this works. He says anything that rusts can burn.
Well, oxidation, it's the same.
It's the same
process.
Fire is just rapid rusting.
Yes.
Basically.
That's a first for us, too.
Yeah. if Roger says it's true. No, of course, it makes sense. Rust is oxidation. The combination of the metal plus oxygen gives you rust.
Yep.
If you could do it fast enough, you'd actually get a combustion. Mm-hmm. And now, by the way, let's read the disclaimer right now before we show this. This is not something for you to try at home, kids. This is absolutely dangerous. Steel wool photography may look harmless. First of all, I've got the burns to say it's not. There is a real risk of personal injury or property damage or death. Nobody's died yet due to fire that we know of.
Not that I know of, but...
So what you're seeing is not instructional.
No, in no way is this meant to be an instructional video.
Don't do this.
We took a lot of precautions that we had to.
Gary, don't let your daughter do this, okay? She's watching, 7 years old, going, Daddy, I want to set metal on fire. So this is what you're using. It's not a Brillo pad. It's not SOS. It's very fine steel wool. Mm-hmm. You'll find this at the home improvement store, right?
Correct.
People use it for like sanding and stuff like
that.
Yeah,
spray paint removal.
It is very fine. And how do you light this on fire? Do you have to have a blowtorch or something?
Nope, just standard lighter, and you go
don't,
for it.
Don't! She almost lit me on fire. All right. So, and by the way, you make the ball. This is all really, I feel like we're making an instructional video. This is a bad idea. Do not do this. Do not take very, very, very fine steel wool,
and put it
fluff it up, put it in a whisk like that,
attached to a puppy.
Do not attach it to a dog leash like that. And whatever you do, if you do that, do not light it on fire.
Correct. Do not do that. Don't take photos of it.
Are you trained in this in any way?
We are trained professionals. That's why we have lab coats.
That's right here. That's everything. So it's all about...
That's the training. They put me in a lab coat. Shall we... we're not going to do it here.
No.
We are going to show you that we did this in an empty parking lot.
Right. Correct.
You want to do it at night because you want it to be dark.
It has to be dark.
But you had nice lights. You had studio lights.
We had lights, and the only way we were able to do it, we used lights, was because we were filming video too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you want to see the before to the
normally
the
you don't
stuff.
Need to film yeah. video. Right. So in order to do that while we're doing video, we use an ND filter for that. But normally you would just set your camera long exposure, and you'll see the results.
Let's take a look.
We're going to burn stuff right now, and I'm hoping that we're not going to burn ourselves as we burn stuff. How come you're not wearing goggles?
No, they're down here.
Oh, okay. So tell us what we're going to do, because I've never done this before.
So first thing you're going to do is, we've already packed the steel wool for you, so we're just going to light it, and
the
then...
The steel wool? Wait a minute.
Spin.
Slow down. You're not burning, like, wood shavings or cotton candy, you're burning steel?
Steel wool.
And so, why is that? Wouldn't it be better to pick something flammable?
Well, steel wool is flammable.
What?
There's enough oxygen in the steel that it burns.
Oh, so because it's such fine little things?
Right. So you
How hard is it to light, though?
It's super easy. So to start a campfire survival basics or whatever, you can actually use steel wool and a battery.
No kidding.
So.
And the battery blows up, and then you've got a fire.
Nice fire.
Stand by the flaming torch! All right, she's using a standard barbecue lighter.
Go for it.
That's it? That's all you have to do?
Oh, here we go. Holy. Oh, my God.
I can feel it in my hair. My precious hair. Fire it up! I think she's aiming at us! Fire in a hole! Wow, that was awesome. That was so much better than I did. That's a trust exercise.
That was, of course, my lovely wife, Lisa Laporte, trying to hit me. So what is this down here? This is a giant ball.
So normally what you were doing is you were burning about
this,
2 inches,
yeah.
Which is one pack, one little tiny spot out of a 12
bunch
pack.
Of this, yeah.
So at the end of the video that me and Amanda did, we burned 4 full packages.
As a giant 2-foot ball.
On top of
2-foot ball.
Right. And that's the one that almost killed you, because I could see it hit you.
The big thing is you see how horribly unathletic I am. And trying to swing it around really proved that, but it was so hot.
It's cool.
It was really hot.
Yeah.
It was really dangerous.
Don't do that one.
It should
that's not
be
good.
Done.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
But it's fun to see the size of that thing. So you told me the trick on this is the Clarity slider in Lightroom. You're shooting this with... in this case, a 5D Mark III. You set it for 10 seconds. You obviously have to get the exposure ahead of time because you're going to be fully manual. You don't want it to blow out. You want it to be bright enough to, to get the sparks, but not too bright.
So one thing we found that made it pretty simple is to get the shot set up and everything so you don't keep running through the steel wool.
Again, this is not an instructional video.
We set the camera for a longer exposure between 8 to 10 seconds, which is what your normal steel wool is going to burn.
8 to 10 seconds.
8 to 10 seconds.
Okay.
And we used a flashlight.
How long did the big ball take?
The big ball is like 25, 30 seconds.
30 seconds, yeah.
It was quite a while.
Right.
So then what we did is we just used a flashlight.
Yeah.
And we sat there and we spun it.
Like the test shot.
Yeah, pointed towards it. And we're looking to make sure that we can see that it's not too dark, too bright. If it's too dark, you play around with the camera settings. You can do it with a DSLR. Which is just a long exposure.
Right.
Or you could do it with a smartphone.
You could do it with a camera phone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right.
For the iPhones, it's pretty easy because you can adjust the shutter speed.
You need manual. Yeah.
On the Android phones, some of them, it's really hard to get the shutter speed.
But on the S6 or the LG G4, no problem.
Right. They have and a manual. Miriam had some good, yeah. I think last week
she's done it on the G4. Yeah, got gaps. Totally raw.
So that's all you really do. You set it up. Then once you're ready and you can tell with the light that's good, you light the steel wool, spin it around. Totally want to have goggles on.
Yes. Well, not that this is an instructional video in any way, but
no.
If you were going to do it, please protect your eyes, not just from the fire, but from little bits of steel wool. You don't want to get steel wool in your eye. That is not good. This stuff is really fine.
Yeah, it gets everywhere. And especially for people who are into computers, don't be playing around with this anywhere near your electronic gear or your camera gear. Because I didn't realize it till after I did it, but there is little tiny fibers everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's better to do it outside.
Your trick in Lightroom was good, which is to pop the clarity. There's a little clarity slider in Lightroom, and that helped bring the sparks up a little bit.
Yeah, so when you bring it in, bring the blacks down just a tiny bit. Bring the clarity up to about 25%. You can go crazy and go higher, but it starts looking way unreal. Another one then is bring your contrast up just a little bit. So you can do it in Bridge, Lightroom, or Photoshop. I go through Bridge there, but I know a lot of people use Lightroom.
Yeah, Bridge will do it, that's right.
Bridge is the best way.
Zach, Amanda, you guys are great. What are you planning next?
Next, we have some stuff with drones that's all top secret. And then farther down the road, something with a whole lot of ST rockets.
A whole lot of rockets. No, really? A whole lot of rockets going on?
A lot of them. Just
this is a good job. Do you get paid to do this, or you just do this for fun?
We get paid to do this.
That is a nice job.
It is.
Good going. Well done.
Anytime anyone creates content for a living and they do something they love,
it's worth it.
It's good.
Because it's not work.
Yeah. Well, I had a lot of fun doing that.
Thanks.
It was fun having you on. Thanks
there.
For inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Zach and Amanda, and thanks to Joby. And everybody, by the way, these are the greatest little things. I have hundreds of these lying all around. These are so useful. And get the right head, and you can put your camera in it and all sorts of your phone in it. Hey, you know, when Ian Thompson was here the other day doing Twit, he had a great tip for us. And we said, wait, hold that thought, and let's put it on the new screensavers. Ian?
Hi, I'm Ian Thompson, a reporter with the Register in San Francisco. Now, it may be a surprise to some of you, but millions of us throw away a really useful tool every day. I am, of course, talking about toilet roll holders. Now, they might not sound like anything that you shouldn't be putting into a recycling bin, but if you're carrying around a lot of leads in the house, or if you've got a lot of sort of small USB cables, they can be invaluable, and this is why. Standard toilet roll holder, put the leads inside, mark it very clearly with what you've got on the inside, and you can just stack it in rows in a standard shoebox, and you're never going to have to fight through that mass of leads that have tangled themselves together again.
Nice. He calls them leads, but that's wires in English.
Oh.
Apparently, we don't speak English. You couldn't hear. No. Roger Chang, Ozzy the dog. And we have the flammable material left over from the burn. I'm so glad you explained that that's just rapid oxidation. It's just rust really fast.
Go ahead.
You're a smart guy. Nice to have you. We do. Oh, I know. I brought this here. The mail's in here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you just stuck it in there.
I just. Shh. That's a secret. So let me get the mail bag out here. And you already have. Oh, you can pick one. Pick one, anyone.
All right. I'll take the middle.
All right.
All right.
Read us an email here.
All right, this comes from Ken, who writes, "Hi, Leo and the rest of the Twit Gang. Been watching since forever."
Nice.
That's an epoch, I
believe.
Love that. "Why do routers keep getting, quote, faster when most people have 15 to 30 megabits? Routers advertise 300, 600, 750, up to 3,200 megabits.
Wow.
I know some of this is combining the frequencies, but at the base speed of 300, it is so much faster than anyone has. It seems the second-gen G routers at 54 megabits would be still enough for most people."
That's a good question. He's talking about Wi-Fi routers,
yes.
Obviously. Because we have here, for instance, we use Cat 6 cable, and we have 10 gigabit Ethernet, which means you can copy about a gigabyte a second, which we use for moving video around. So, yeah, you need that speed on wired, but wireless.
Wireless, the thing to understand is when you have a router, it isn't just about getting an internet connection, it's about creating a local network.
Right.
And if you have a lot of people not only surfing, but also transferring files, say, from one machine to another, it starts to get congested.
And they're all using it.
Yes.
So really that number, the other thing to remember is that's a nominal number, and I think Patrick said this a couple of episodes ago, you're not going to get full number. You're going to get about half of that at
You
best.
Have packet overhead, and you also have back and forth noise and stuff that has to work out. So typically you're never going to, I have a 300 or a 300 uh, make
Is AC 300 megabits?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's but never seen it.
It's also the spec war, right?
Yeah.
It's the same reason why you need a 4 gigahertz microprocessor. You don't need a 4 gigahertz microprocessor. And most of these Intel processors aren't running at 4 megahertz except when they're fully maxed out. Most of the time they're slower. Their speed stepped down.
Except for me, it actually runs.
You max your, because you're doing editing, right?
I bought a 4790K, so its speed is.
It's fixed?
At 4 gigahertz, and then
you
the turbo boosts up.
You don't need that.
Oh, when you encode, when you render, you watch everything spike.
So there are a lot of times they put these numbers on there because they think it's going to sell. I do think, though, you're not looking at the numbers, but you are looking at the standard, and I think 802.11 AC now is what you want to get. It's still hasn't been ratified, but it will be any day now as a standard, right?
It's definitely something where, N took forever to come around, but I have an N router.
N's fine.
And I use it mainly because in my neighborhood there's a lot of Wi-Fi routers, and not a lot of people use N, so it's one way for me to kind of avoid
my
some
point
of the,
exactly
the conflicts.
Getting the latest will get you a little bit of maybe a head above the other people. Having MIMO, the multiple antennas, most importantly for me, dual band 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz, because everybody's on 2.4.
yes,
so if you can use 5, all your stuff handles 5, you're going to be able to get out of the congestion, get above it, and it'll work much better.
Yeah, and again, it's not just about getting, oh yeah, you only have a 60 megabit connection to the internet, and
it's a holistic thing.
Yeah, you have to factor in a bunch of other things.
This is from Brian in Kentucky. Hi, Leah, loving Google Photos. Have you used Google Photos? Yes, this new Google.
It automatically uses it for me.
It's so awesome. He says, I'm in the process of uploading 40,000 plus photos, as am I. I have about 40,000 photos in my Lightroom, and it's just uploading. I mean, it takes a little while. They have an uploader for desktop. I'm trying to find out how to get my wife access to these photos. She's loving searching through them and what Google's doing with the pics. I currently have all our photos in Picasa, which is basically what Google bought to make this possible, through a shared network computing. Do I have to have her log into my Google Plus, or is there an easy way to share them? All of the files, sharing them all, yeah, there's no, this is one problem I have with Google Music, Google Photos. It's tied to your Google account, and you don't want to give anybody, even your wife, your Google login, I think. But I don't know of any other way to share the whole Photos library than to let her log in as you.
If you create folders, you can share.
You can share individual folders.
So if you segment them out to, say, like vacation photos, and then share that with her.
I guess you could share everything, but you have to do a folder at a time.
It's going to be tedious.
Yeah, to say the least.
It's not going to be a one-night operation.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, though. You can say, look at this folder.
Yeah.
But she can look at it, and then she can decide whether or not she wants to download it.
Or
if she's going to modify it, she needs to download it. I don't think you can modify it.
I know you can
folder.
Make photos public, but I wonder if you can share it with certain people within your groups.
Well, you can on Google Plus, but see, this has been extracted from Google Plus, so it's hard to say. I think that is one reason I'm not crazy. Same thing with Google Music. There's no way to share it.
I've never used it.
I like Google Music.
I've never used it.
Never used it. I like it. It's good. You should try it. Actually, with Spotify now, it's all I use.
You know what?
Are you a Spotify guy?
No, I still use Pandora.
Why are we whispering?
I don't know.
It's a secret.
I still use Pandora because I have a really bad habit of listening to the same musicians and artists and songs over again. And I really do like having a rotation of new content into my stream that I would have never picked otherwise.
Right. By the way, people are saying, oh, just use Chromecast. It's not the issue of sharing the photos. She wants to be able to search through them and look at them and maybe even modify them. She wants full access to them, not just a slideshow.
Just give her your account. You're married.
Yeah. By the way, I don't think... what the hell? What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, you share a bank account, right? Right.
No, you do? You share a bank account
with
your wife?
Aren't you supposed to?
no, just teasing you. Yes, of course. I was surprised because I thought that, Chromecast has this nice backdrop thing where you can put your photos in there. They haven't yet updated it to use Google Photos. I want it to use Google Photos. I don't think it does. I think it's using the old system. So we got to make... Uh-oh, Lisa's looking at me funny. See, when your wife's sitting right there on the other side of the glass, you got to be nice. Anyway, Brian, thanks for the email. As far as I know, there's not a way to do that. Here, why don't you read this last one?
All right. In the last few episodes, we've talked about the old school screensavers like Flying Toasters. These were developed for Mac.
You remember Flying Toasters?
Oh, yeah.
Look at it. I think we have... Wait a minute. Let's just see, because I think... Yeah, we do. We have it right in here, the Flying Toasters. It's in the fireproof can.
Oh, nice. It has the original label from Babbage's.
That's Alex Scumple. He doesn't have a Mac. He uses Windows, but he has some weird habit of collecting old Mac stuff, but it has to be shrink-wrapped in the box. He's just strange.
You know, there's an entire group somewhere online that do nothing but collect sealed video games.
Yeah, I think he's in that group.
Actually, you do realize that actually doesn't retain any value.
just checking. He's on our handheld today. You got to be careful. Anyway, what is he saying?
They say these were developed for Macs up to OS 9 and then abandoned.
Right.
Now
by Berkeley Systems. Yeah, there they are. How do you do that?
I think
it's... Is that a TriCaster effect?
No, I think that's...
Everything's a TriCaster effect.
Between two images. Now the After Dark screensavers are available in OS 10 thanks to Infinis Limited and Stick software.
Oh, nice.
You can download Flying Toasters, Mowing Man, and Boris for $7.
Remember Mowing Man? He'd mow the lawn on your screen?
I used to mow the lawn for my dad. It's not something I need to see.
There's some
really banal...
Oh, look, the kitties are back.
And then Rose and Satori, two popular screensavers from After Dark 2.0 and 3.0, are now free.
Nice. What's that site again?
It goes Infinis Limited and Stick Software.
I-N-I-N-F-I-N-N-S.
I-N-F-I-N-I-S-Y-S Limited and Stick Software.
I'll put it in the show.
Infinisys.
I-N-F-I-F-S-S. Swiss. Roger Chang. You didn't get Changri once.
No.
Are you a new man? You relaxed, you're calm,
no.
You don't see red?
I'm the same person. I'm the same person. I'm probably about 15 pounds heavier.
I thought fatherhood might have calmed you down, even you out.
I'm calm around her. Yeah. Like, things like, well, I mean, they're babies, so.
How can you not be
calm? I mean, like, if an adult did that around me, I'd punch him.
But, like pee in your face? Yeah, I know what
but
you
if,
mean.
But it's a
oh,
baby.
Oh, you have a daughter. Yeah.
Yes, so.
My son would, you know, you'd take off the diaper and immediately pee in your face.
No, I don't know why.
Daughters
can actually pee pretty high, too.
Okay, that's good. We've learned something.
Sounds like a hot button topic.
Sons or daughters, who can pee farther next on the new Screensavers? Hey, we thank you for being here, Roger Chang. It's great
thank
to
you
see
very
you again.
Much for
I love working
me.
My old buddies. We'll catch your work on DTNS.
Yes.
And then in about 20 years, we'll catch your work as your daughter goes out into the world. And we'll say, there she goes.
I'll play White Snakes. Here I go.
Here I go again. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We do this new Screensavers on Saturday afternoons. Think of it as Sábado Gigante que go. Gigante?
Gigante.
Gigante. We're taking over from Sábado Gigante.
Without the spokesmodels.
Yeah. I'm going to get a guy in a bee suit, though, for sure. Every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. You can catch it also on our website, twit.tv/TNSS, or is it just NSS?
NSS.
NSS. twit.tv/NSS. And, of course, you know, Twit's been around long enough that we're on every podcatcher and aggregator and the mobile apps and all of that jazz. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye, everybody. Woo-hoo!